Morning.
I'm still Bob Parmley, and I'm still a real alcoholic.
Hi, Bob.
Looks like we've lost about half of our crowd. We're down to probably 1,000 people. It's not been videoed, so they'll never know, you know. They eat your heart out, Charlie. We looked last night at the exact nature of the problem. We looked at the physical allergy and the mental obsession, and then we looked at a person who had the disease of alcoholism and how it progressed in his life, and what he did about it, the beginning of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and the beginning of the fellowship itself when they started organizing and having meetings. And now we're going to look at chapter 2, which talks about there is a solution. It wouldn't do us any good to know what the problem is if we're talking to another person, if we can tell him what his problem is, if we don't know what his solution is. I was told that if you're talking to a person and he can't see the solution, and he thinks the alcohol is all the solution he has, is to leave him alone because that's all he's got. We of Alcoholics Anonymous know thousands of men and women who were once just as hopeless as Bill. Nearly all have recovered. They have solved the drink problem. They've solved the drink problem. They still got the physical allergy. They still can't drink successfully. But they have found a way to control the mental obsession to drink. So they have recovered. We are average Americans. All sections of this country and many of its occupations are represented, as well as many political, economic, social, and religious backgrounds. We are people who would normally not mix, but there exists among us a fellowship, a friendliness, and an understanding which is indescribably wonderful. We are like the passengers of a great liner the moment just after rescue from shipwreck, where camaraderie, joyousness, and democracy pervade the vessel from steerage to captain's table. Unlike the feeling of the ship's passengers, however, our joy in escape from disaster does not subside as we go our individual ways. The feeling of having shared in a common peril is one element in the powerful cement that binds us, the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. But that in itself would never have held us together as we are now joined. Always beware of what follows the but. But that in itself would never have held us together as we are now joined. The tremendous fact for every one of us is that we have discovered a common solution.
12 steps.
We have a way out on which we can absolutely agree, and upon which we join in brotherly and harmonious action. This is the great news this book carries to those who suffer from alcoholism. The book carries, the program carries, that message of recovery. Now, there's two powers in Alcoholics Anonymous: the power of the fellowship itself, the power of being with a group of people who had the same problem and who have found the same solution, and the power of the program itself, the personality change sufficient to stay sober. Butch.
Good morning. I'm an alcoholic. My name's Butch Clark.
Hey,
I'm glad to be here this morning, and I'd like to thank these people again for giving me the opportunity to come here and do what I love to do, which is talk about the Big Book Alcoholics Anonymous. And what we are going to find out, or what we're going to notice, I hope, is that they title this chapter, "There Is a Solution," and then they turn right around and start talking about the problem again. And I believe that if we're talking about the problem and trying to understand what it is, then we are actually talking about the solution too. We're learning all we can about the solution by learning about the problem. So they're going to review again and again. They're going to let us know what our problem is. They're going to tell us what the solution is going to have to be. And they're leading us up to a point where we'll make a decision after a while. On page 18, an illness of this sort, and we have come to believe it an illness, involves those about us in a way no other human sickness can. If a person has cancer, all are sorry for him, and no one is angry or hurt. But not so with the alcoholic illness, for with it there goes annihilation of all the things worthwhile in life. It engulfs all whose lives touch the sufferers. It brings misunderstanding, fierce resentment, financial insecurity, disgusted friends and employers, warped lives of blameless children, sad wives and parents. Anyone can increase the list. And we've all known people like that who have had one disease or another that we know is a disease, and we don't have to search for an understanding that it's a disease. And it just doesn't raise the feelings that this disease raises in other people. And these other people are probably never going to be able to understand what our problem is. And an attempt on my part to try to explain that to them has so far been an exercise in futility. I need to know what I know in order for me to live safely and comfortably as an alcoholic. And I have found that the more I know, the less things that I have to take the rap for. Because if I know that I'm right, then I don't have to carry around that constant worry. Could I have done things differently? Let's skip a page and turn to page 20. You may already have asked yourself why it is that all of us became so very ill from drinking. Doubtless you are curious to discover how and why, in the face of expert opinion to the contrary, we have recovered from a hopeless condition of mind and body. If you are an alcoholic who wants to get over it, you may already be asking, what do I have to do? It is the purpose of this book to answer such questions specifically. We shall tell you what we have done. Before going into a detailed discussion, it may be well to summarize some points as we see them. Now here they go again. They're going to tell me what they've already told me. How many times people have said to us, I can take it or leave it alone. Why can't he? Why don't you drink like a gentleman or quit? That fellow can't handle his liquor. Why don't you try beer and wine? Lay off the hard stuff. His willpower must be weak. He could stop if he wanted to. She's such a sweet girl. I should think he'd stop for her sake. The doctor told him that if he ever drank again, it would kill him. But there he is, all lit up again. Now these are commonplace observations on drinkers, which we hear all the time. Back of them is a world of ignorance and misunderstanding. We see that these expressions refer to people whose reactions are very different from ours. And they also refer to people, I believe, that do not understand what the problem is, because I've had some of these same reactions even after coming to Alcoholics Anonymous. Moderate drinkers have little trouble in giving up liquor entirely if they have good reason for it. They can take it or leave it alone. Then we have a certain type of hard drinker. He may have the habit badly enough to gradually impair him physically and mentally. It may cause him to die a few years before his time. If a sufficiently strong reason, ill health, falling in love, change of environment, or the warning of a doctor becomes operative, this man can also stop or moderate, although he may find it difficult and troublesome and may even need medical attention. But what about the real alcoholic? He may start off as a moderate drinker. He may or may not become a continuous hard drinker. But at some stage of his drinking career, he begins to lose all control of his liquor consumption once he starts to drink.
And now we know why. Because the allergy of the body.
Exactly. And as we read through this, these questions are the questions that these statements raise. I need to answer these for myself. You know, I have spent a lot of time in the Fellowship Alcoholics Anonymous trying to understand how to answer questions the way you would want me to answer questions, trying to understand God the way you would have me understand God, and that's something that I could not do in the first place. So now that I know better, I can do a little bit better, and I need to answer these questions for me and not worry about your thinking on the matter. It says, here is the fellow who has been puzzling you, especially in his lack of control. He does absurd, incredible, tragic things while drinking. He is a real Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. He is seldom mildly intoxicated. He is always more or less insanely drunk. His disposition while drinking resembles his normal nature but little. He may be one of the finest fellows in the world. Yet let him drink for a day, and he frequently becomes disgustingly and even dangerously antisocial. He has a positive genius for getting tight at exactly the wrong moment, particularly when some important decision must be made or engagement kept. He is often perfectly sensible and well-balanced concerning everything except liquor, but in that respect he is incredibly dishonest and selfish. He often possesses special abilities, skills, and aptitudes, and has a promising career ahead of him. He uses his gifts to build up a bright outlook for his family and himself, and then pulls the structure down on his head by a senseless series of sprees. He is the fellow who goes to bed so intoxicated he ought to sleep the clock around, yet early next morning he searches madly for the bottle he misplaced the night before. If he can afford it, he may have liquor concealed all over his house to be certain no one gets his entire supply away from him to throw down the waste pipe. As matters grow worse, he begins to use a combination of high-powered sedative and liquor to quiet his nerves so he can go to work. Then comes the day when he simply cannot make it and gets drunk all over again. Perhaps he goes to a doctor who gives him morphine or some sedative with which to taper off. Then he begins to appear at hospitals and treatment centers, sanitariums. This is by no means a comprehensive picture of the true alcoholic, as our behavior patterns vary, but this description should identify him roughly. And these things that we're talking about only deal with the behavior of an alcoholic, talking about what an alcoholic does, not necessarily what an alcoholic is. And that was the biggest mix-up that I had in my mind as I came in here and tried to figure out what it is that I had to do. I asked that question that we asked this morning, just what is it that I have to do? And I got a lot of answers, and I tried to do a lot of it. But if something seemed a little bit too personal or difficult, then I'd go and ask someone else, and I could always find someone that would tell me something to do that I would like to do that day. It asks, why does he behave like this? If hundreds of experiences have shown him that one drink means another debacle with all its attendant suffering and humiliation, why is it he takes that drink, that one drink? Why can't he stay on the water wagon? What has become of the common sense and willpower that he still sometimes displays with respect to other matters? That's the insanity of alcoholism. The obsession to take a drink to solve his problem will not allow him to remember what alcohol does to him on a time after time consistent basis. That will become my main problem. It's in my mind, not in my body, because I no longer drink. Perhaps there never will be a full answer to these questions. Opinions vary considerably as to why the alcoholic reacts differently from normal people. We are not sure why, once a certain point is reached, little can be done for him. We cannot answer the riddle. We know that while the alcoholic keeps away from drink, as he may do for months or years, he reacts much like other men. We are equally positive that once he takes any alcohol, whatever, into his system, something happens, both in the bodily and mental sense, which makes it virtually impossible for him to stop. The experience of any alcoholic will abundantly confirm this. These observations would be academic and pointless if our friend never took that first drink, thereby setting the terrible cycle in motion. Therefore, the main problem of the alcoholic centers in his mind rather than his body. And I'm going to read that again. Therefore, the main problem of the alcoholic centers in his mind rather than his body. If you ask him why he started on that last bender, the chances are he will offer you any one of 100 alibis. Sometimes these excuses have a certain plausibility. Sometimes they make sense, even to me. But none of them really make sense in the light of the havoc an alcoholic's drinking bout creates. They sound like the philosophy of the man who, having a headache, beats himself on the head with a hammer so that he can't feel the ache. If you draw this fallacious reasoning to the attention of an alcoholic, he will laugh it off or become irritated and refuse to talk. And I know that I was one of those alcoholics that continued to become irritated and refuse to talk even after trying to recover for 3 or 4 years as a dry alcoholic. If I did not understand what you were trying to tell me, I simply laughed it off or became irritated and refused to talk to you, in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous even. Once in a while, he may tell the truth, and the truth, strange to say, is usually that he has no more idea why he took that first drink than you have. Some drinkers have excuses with which they are satisfied part of the time, but in their hearts they really do not know why they do it. Once this malady has a real hold, they are a baffled lot. There is the obsession or the lie that somehow, someday, they will beat the game, but they often suspect they are down for the count. And we can perform a little experiment and do just exactly what they say right in this book and approach the people around us and ask these questions and see who is willing to say, I don't know. And until I could say, I don't know, then I could not begin to learn what I had to learn in order to identify my problem, understand my solution, or to learn the steps, the action necessary to bring about that solution.
As long as I think I know what the problem is, and I know what the answer is, and I know what the plan program of action is, I can't make any progress at all. As long as I know. You know, I was talking to a young man not too long ago, and he said, I've never had any problem with this God thing because I knew God when I got here. I thought to myself, wonder why you got here if you already knew God. God as I understood him. The tragic truth is that if the man be a real alcoholic, now he's going to talk about real alcoholic a lot. Real alcoholic, true alcoholic, potential alcoholic. But he's going to talk about being a real alcoholic a lot. And I know that sometimes some of us have said that we are real alcoholics, and it makes people a little angry because they don't understand what we're saying. One fellow thought I was trying to separate myself from the rest of the alcoholics and Alcoholics Anonymous, and it's not that at all. It's just that I know what a real alcoholic is now, and I know that that's what I am. And if I'm a real alcoholic, then I've got to have a real program of recovery. The tragic truth is that if the man be a real alcoholic, the happy day might not arrive. He has lost control. At a certain point in the drinking of every alcoholic, he passes into a state where the most powerful desire to stop drinking is of absolutely no avail. This tragic situation has already arrived in practically every case long before it is suspected. I always thought that I saw what alcohol did to people in the little town where I was growing up, and then when I moved to Georgia, I saw what alcohol did to people, and I always thought, you know, if alcohol ever begins to affect me that way, if it ever begins to start causing me problems, then I'll just quit. And it started causing me problems. So I said, well, if alcohol ever causes me major problems, then I'll just quit. And it started causing me major problems. And then I said, if it ever causes me major problems consistently, then I'll just quit. And it started causing me major problems consistently, and I set out to quit and found out I couldn't. Found out that I could not leave it alone, no matter the necessity. I had to keep on drinking. The fact is that most alcoholics, for reasons yet obscure, have lost the power of choice in drink. Our so-called willpower becomes practically non-existent. We are unable at certain times to bring into our consciousness with sufficient force the memory of the suffering and humiliation of even a week or a month ago. We are without defense against the first drink. And we take that first drink and trigger the allergy. We go on and get drunk, and we're in all kinds of trouble, full of guilt, shame, and remorse. And we don't know why we took that first drink. The almost certain consequences that follow taking even a glass of beer do not crowd into the mind to deter us. If these thoughts occur, they are hazy and readily supplanted with the old threadbare idea that this time we shall handle ourselves like other people. There is complete failure of the kind of defense that keeps one from putting his hand on a hot stove. The idea that alcohol is going to do me harm just simply does not come. I can't remember. My mind would not remember the harm that alcohol did to me, but it would certainly remember how good it made me feel at one time. And I've been told if alcohol don't make you feel good to start with, you'll probably never drink enough of it to make you feel bad, to do harm to you. The alcoholic may say to himself in the most casual way, it won't burn me this time, so here's how. Or perhaps he doesn't think at all. How often have some of us begun to drink in this nonchalant way and after the third or fourth pounded on the bar and said to ourselves, for God's sakes, how did I ever get started again? I have those dreams occasionally, you know, where you start drinking again and you think, boy, now I've got to go back down there to Gym City with Speedy and take another white chip and how in the world did I get started again, you know? Only to have that thought supplanted, well, I'll stop with the sixth drink, or what the hell anyway? What's the use anyhow? Who cares? What difference does it make? All of those excuses. When this sort of thinking, this is the insane part of alcoholism, when this sort of thinking is fully established in an individual with alcoholic tendencies, he has probably placed himself beyond human aid and unless locked up may die or go permanently insane. You know, I heard a speaker not too long ago talking about, you know, we tell these people when they come into the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous that we're going to love you until you can learn to love yourself. He said what we ought to be trying to tell them is that if you have the disease of alcoholism and you're a real alcoholic, you've got a disease that's very definitely going to kill you. You're going to live a horrible death. I mean, you're going to live a horrible life and die a terrible death if you are a real alcoholic. That's what we need to be telling them. Not some idea that we are going to love you until you can love yourself. Now, basically, that's what we do in the fellowship and in the program. If we teach them the principles of the program and they get on it and get sober to live happy, joyous, and free, we've taught them to love their self through the principles of the program itself. These stark and ugly facts have been confirmed by legions of alcoholics throughout history. But for the grace of God, there would have been thousands more convincing demonstrations. So many want to stop, but cannot. There is a solution. Almost none of us like the self-searching, the leveling of our pride, the confession of shortcomings, which the process requires for its successful consummation. Over here on page 20, he asked the question, what do I have to do? Now, they've got the program down a couple of sentences here. Almost none of us like the self-searching, the leveling of our pride, the confession of shortcomings which the process requires for its successful consummation. That's what we have to do. And we're given a plan program of action to bring about that statement. But we see that it really worked in others. We came to suspect by coming to meetings to the fellowship and seeing this program work in other people's lives, and we came to suspect that if it worked for them, it might just possibly work for us. When therefore we were approached by those in whom the problem had been solved, there was nothing left for us but to pick up the simple kit of spiritual tools laid at our feet. Here are the steps we took. We have found much of heaven, and we have been rocketed into a fourth dimension of existence of which we had not even dreamed. Bill talks a lot about, not a lot, but he does mention several times the fourth dimension. The great fact is just this and nothing less, that we have had deep and effective spiritual experiences which have revolutionized our whole attitude toward life, toward our fellows, and toward God's universe. The central fact of our lives today is the absolute certainty that our Creator has entered into our hearts and lives in a way which is indeed miraculous. He has commenced to accomplish those things for us which we could never do by ourselves. I remember my first days in AA. I spent all my time begging God to forgive me for something He didn't condemn me for, and begging God to do something for me that I could have been doing for myself. You know, the program promises that God will do for me what I cannot do for myself, but He won't do for me what I won't do for myself. So I've got certain things that I have to do, actions that I have to take, and what I can do about my problem will be done for me, and I believe that. If you are as seriously alcoholic as we are, we believe there is no middle-of-the-road solution. Half measures will avail us nothing. We were in a position where life was becoming impossible, and if we had passed into the region from which there is no return through human aid, we had but two alternatives. One was to go on to the bitter end, blocking out the consciousness of our intolerable situation as best we could.
Step one.
And the other, to accept spiritual help.
Step two.
This we did because we honestly wanted to, and we were willing to make the effort. Now here's a story about a young man that goes to the doctor, and he seems to have plenty of money because he goes to Europe to see Dr. Jung, and he's got a problem with alcohol, and Dr. Jung is prescribing for him, as they said in those days. A certain American businessman had ability, good sense, and high character. If you'll notice, most of the stories they talk about people recovering in the book are people just like that. They have ability, they're businessmen, they have good sense and high character.
Just like us.
Just like us, yeah. For years he had floundered from one sanitarium to another. He had consulted the best known American psychiatrist. Then he had gone to Europe, placing himself in the care of a celebrated physician, the psychiatrist Dr. Jung, who prescribed for him. Though experience had made him skeptical, he finished his treatment with unusual confidence. His physical and mental condition were unusually good. He's in good health. Above all, he believed he had acquired such a profound knowledge of the inner workings of his mind and its hidden springs that relapse was unthinkable. Nevertheless, he was drunk in a short time. More baffling still, he could give himself no satisfactory explanation for his fall. Now, in this next paragraph is the key to his problem. The key to why he could not recover, why he couldn't get sober. So he returned to this doctor, whom he admired, and asked him point blank why he could not recover. He wished above all things to regain self-control. Regain self-control. He wants to go back to drinking like he did when he first started going to see the doctor, when he could control his drinking. He wants to regain. He thinks all this effort is to regain self-control. He seemed quite rational and well-balanced with respect to other problems, yet he had no control whatever over alcohol. Why was this? Because he has a problem that he can't solve, a problem that the harder he tries to solve it, the worse the problem becomes. The worse the problem becomes, the harder he tries to solve it. And just, you know, the dilemma of the problem of alcoholism. He has no power to drink, no power to quit drinking, and no power to regain control over what he drinks. He's allergic to alcohol. If he takes any alcohol in his body at all, he triggers the phenomenon of craving. And then when he tries to quit, he finds that he cannot quit entirely. And he's wanting to regain self-control. He begged the doctor to tell him the whole truth, and he got it. In the doctor's judgment, he was utterly hopeless. He could never regain his position in society, and he would have to place him under lock and key or hire a bodyguard if he expected to live long. This was a great physician's opinion. But something happened. But this man still lives and is a free man. He does not need a bodyguard, nor is he confined. He can go anywhere on this earth where other free men go without disaster, provided he remains willing to maintain a certain simple attitude. Some of our alcoholic readers may think they can do without spiritual help. Let us tell you the rest of the conversation our friend had with this doctor, with his doctor. The doctor said, you have the mind of a chronic alcoholic. Joe says the chronic alcoholic is you do it more than twice. I have never seen one single case recover where that state of mind existed to the extent that it does in you. Our friend felt as though the gates of hell had closed on him with a clang. He said to the doctor, is there no exception? Yes, replied the doctor, there is. Exceptions to cases such as yours have been occurring since early times. Here and there, and every once in a while, alcoholics have had what are called vital spiritual experiences. To me, these occurrences are phenomena. They're not explainable. They appear to be in the nature of huge emotional displacement and rearrangements.
Change.
Ideas, emotions, and attitudes, which were once the guiding force of the lives of these men, are suddenly cast to one side.
Change.
And a completely new set of conceptions and motives begin to dominate them. In fact, I have been trying to produce such emotional rearrangement within you.
More change.
With many individuals, the methods which I have employed are successful, but I have never been successful with an alcoholic of your description. Upon hearing this, our friend was somewhat relieved, for he reflected that after all, he was a good church member. This hope, however, was destroyed by the doctors telling him that while his religious convictions were very good, in his case, they did not spell the necessary vital spiritual experience.
That's the second time we've seen that little thing there.
Yeah.
Let's go over and see what it's trying to tell us. Let's turn back to the back of the book, to Appendix 2, and they're going to talk about a vital spiritual experience. Now, I know that I can have a lot of spiritual experiences because I believe that that is anything that comes to my mind that makes me feel good. But I am looking for one that is going to give me something that I'm going to find back here. We'll read on page 569. They've already asked us to look at this twice, and we'll see why. The terms spiritual experience and spiritual awakening are used many times in this book, which upon careful reading shows that the personality change sufficient to bring about recovery from alcoholism has manifested itself among us in many different forms. Now, I'm going to read that again because that is the result of the spiritual awakening that I'm looking for. That's what I have to have, and that's what I'm going to be asking from the 12-step program, Alcoholics Anonymous. This is the result I'm looking for. The personality change sufficient to bring about recovery from alcoholism. And this has manifested itself among us in many different forms. Yet it is true that our first printing gave many readers the impression that these personality changes or religious experiences must be in the nature of sudden and spectacular upheavals. Happily for everyone, this conclusion is erroneous. In the first few chapters, a number of sudden revolutionary changes are described. Though it was not our intention to create such an impression, many alcoholics have nevertheless concluded that in order to recover, they must acquire an immediate and overwhelming God consciousness, followed at once by a vast change in feeling and outlook. They're going to tell me to change about 15 different ways in this one page. Among our rapidly growing membership of thousands of alcoholics, such transformations, there's another one, though frequent, are by no means the rule. Most of our experiences are what the psychologist William James calls the educational variety, because they develop slowly over a period of time. In other words, I change as I learn. When I know better, I can do better. Quite often, friends of the newcomer are aware of the difference long before he is himself. He finally realizes, now that I believe there it is again, that's when I know it. He finally realizes that he has undergone a profound alteration in his reaction to life, that such a change could hardly have been brought about by himself alone. What often takes place in a few months could seldom have been accomplished by years of self-discipline. With few exceptions, our members find that they have tapped an unsuspected inner resource, a higher power, which they presently identify with their own conception of a power greater than themselves. Most of us think this awareness of a power greater than ourselves is the essence of spiritual experience. Our more religious members call it God consciousness. Most emphatically, we wish to say that any alcoholic capable of honestly facing his problems in the light of our experience can recover, provided he does not close his mind to all spiritual concepts. He can only be defeated by an attitude of intolerance or belligerent denial. We find that no one need have difficulty with the spirituality of the program. Willingness, honesty, and open-mindedness are the essentials of recovery, but these are indispensable. And then this little side here says, there is a principle which is a bar against all information, which is proof against all arguments, and which cannot fail to keep a man in everlasting ignorance. That principle is contempt prior to investigation. And that is something that I did not know that I did so much. But it's a byproduct of my alcoholism, these fixed ideas. Because I went along through life, I had no idea that I couldn't drink safely. I had no idea that I couldn't stop. And all of the thinking that I came up to excuse all that was the lies that came along with alcoholism. It says, what often takes place in a few months could seldom have been accomplished by years of self-discipline. Now, in some cases, I could discipline myself, but I had no idea why I was doing it. That's the key. The information that goes along, we could probably just write a list of rules how we need to live our life for the rest of it, and that would be pretty effective. But it wouldn't do me any good because I wouldn't know why. And that's the key to what I'm going to have to learn to have in order to have a spiritual experience. And some things have already begun to happen that's going to bring this about. I did want to say something about the fact that we talked about having ability, good sense, and high character. And when I first came to the program or the fellowship, Alcoholics Anonymous, I could not see that at all because I was continually trying to convince you that I was just the opposite. I had to excuse my alcohol consumption and my behavior. It was so strong that I explained it, that I told you that I had no ability, that I had no sense, that I had no character, that I was weak-willed, and that I was crazy. And now that the first step has relieved me of these lies, I can take a look at the bright and positive side of my life, and I can celebrate the family that I raised, and I can understand that I do have ability, good sense, and high character, and that I might be able now to understand what you're trying to teach me. Thank you, Bob.
The term spiritual experience, which happens quickly, and spiritual awakening, which happens slowly, this talks about it being a change of the educational variety, which showed me that if I'm going to have to educate, if I'm going to have to learn, I'm going to have a teacher, and I need a textbook. And, you know, as long as I've been around AA, people just do not like the idea of teaching Alcoholics Anonymous. And I've tried to understand that you can't teach sobriety. You have to live sobriety. You have to learn sobriety yourself. But we can teach the principles of the program itself to bring about that sobriety. Teaching the principles is not, it's a fairly simple deal, you know, just the 12 steps and what they mean. We in our turn sought the same escape with all the desperation of drowning men. What seemed at first a flimsy reed has proved to be the loving and powerful hand of God. We have no desire to convince anyone that there is only one way by which faith can be acquired. If what we have learned and felt and seen means anything at all, it means that all of us, whatever our race, creed, or color, are the children of a living God, a living Creator, with whom we may form a relationship upon simple and understandable terms as soon as we are willing and honest enough to give it a shot, to try. Those having religious affiliations will find there's nothing disturbing to their beliefs or ceremonies. There is no friction among us over such matters. We think it no concern of ours what religious bodies our members identify themselves with as individuals. This should be an entirely personal affair, which each one decides for himself in the light of past associations or his present choice. Not all of us join religious bodies. but most of us favor such memberships. In the following chapter, there appears an explanation of alcoholism as we understand it.
Again.
Then a chapter, excuse me.
That's all right. They're going to tell us again.
The same things.
Mm-hmm.
The problem, the solution. Many who once were in this class are now among our members. Surprisingly enough, we find such convictions no great obstacle to a spiritual experience. I've often thought if they'd have just said personality change sufficient to stay sober, it would have been a whole lot easier for me. Because I believe I could have understood that a lot quicker than I could a spiritual experience. You know, like I told you before, if I already know, I can't know. And I already knew what a spiritual experience was. I'd seen them old ladies up there in Tennessee have one, you know, where they get to shouting and carrying on. They have a spiritual experience, and I didn't want nothing to do with that. So I already knew what a spiritual experience was, and I already knew I didn't need it and didn't want it. And besides that, I was already not drinking. And if I'm not drinking, I'm not getting drunk. And if I'm not drinking and I'm not getting drunk, I thought I was sober. I thought that was it, you know. And I'd hear these people talk about doing these steps and working all that, and I'd think, well, why do they have to do that? I didn't. I didn't have to do none of that, you know. I just quit drinking. And when I quit drinking, I quit getting drunk. Simple program, wasn't it? Except I forgot about that one thing that would one day, once more, that alcohol would call me back. And it did one afternoon. It called me back. I would have taken a drink with anybody at any time and let them drink first. And I come home from work and I didn't think about drinking. I wasn't, to the best of my knowledge, drinking hadn't even entered my mind. But by the time I got home, that compulsion had come back to me after about 3.5 or 4 years of being dry. And I went out on the porch and I couldn't even go in the house. And my wife come out and said, what's the matter with you? And I said, God damn you, leave me alone. And she said, my goodness, what's the matter with you? And I said, I want a drink. And I took off through the woods like a wild man. I mean, I just took off through the woods, just running and walking. And I stayed out there till I was almost exhausted, and I come back, and I didn't drink. And another time, I was going to go drink, and just as I started out the door, Lynn called, the Delta Airlines stewardess, called and asked me, did I know Gloria? Did I remember Gloria? Speedy, you remember her, don't you? Airline stewardess. And I said, yeah, Lynn, I know who you're talking about. And she said, well, they just found her dead. Alcohol poisoning and drug overdose. And I sat down and talked to Lynn a few minutes, and that's just another day that I didn't go drink. And my whole sobriety has been like that, you know, just one day at a time, growing away from taking that first drink. Each individual in the personal stories describes in his own language and from his own point of view the way he established his relationship with God. Now that's the stories in the back of the book, and if you're not reading those and understanding them and trying to get something out of them, you're missing part of the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous. The program itself is in the first 164 pages. But those people in the back of the book are carrying a message to us. Each individual in his personal story describes in his own language and from his own point of view the way he established his relationship with God as he understands God. These give a fair cross-section of our membership and a clear-cut idea of what has actually happened in their lives. We hope no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women desperately in need will see these pages, and we believe that it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that they will be persuaded to say, yes, I am one of them too. I must have this thing. My friend Jack from up in Louisville used to be the employee assistance man for the L&N Railroad, and I was scared to death of that man. I used to have nightmares about people say, Jack Sullivan wants to talk. I wasn't going to tell his last name, but I did, didn't I? Jack wants to talk to you about my drinking, see, because he was the man on the railroad. I talked to him not too awful long ago, and he said these new people that they have, you know, are psychologists, and they're trained in that field of employee assistance, and he said they do it a little different than I did. They'll call the superintendent or the supervisor and say, you have that young man in my office at 1:30 on Wednesday afternoon. And he said, of course, that gives him a week to get straightened out and get all cleaned up and come talk to you and know what he's going to talk about. And he said, the way I operated was, I'd call the crew caller and say, you tell me when you're going to call him and I'll go get him. He'd come out there on the road and get you, wouldn't he, Butch? But he was, he said he gave a talk one time up in Washington, D.C. to a group of interdenominational ministers, and after he told his story, one of the little preachers come pressing up to him, you know, and said, Jack, don't you find it degrading to tell those things about yourself? And he said, I thought a few minutes, and I said, no, I don't find it degrading at all. I may be the only person in this room that knows what his problem is and knows what his solution is, so I don't find it degrading at all. And we shouldn't, especially when we're talking to each other. Now, more about alcoholism. We'll get into this just a little bit, and then we'll take a break. I think probably, I've been told this, and I think it's probably true, Bill's probably already told us as much as we need to know about the problem and solution. But he also knows the alcoholic mind, that keen intellectual alcoholic mind that can find a loophole in anything. So he writes another chapter and plugs up all the holes. Most of us have been unwilling to admit we were real alcoholics. Now, unless I know what a real alcoholic is, I'm not going to admit that I'm one, am I? I'm not going to know what one is. No person likes to think he is bodily and mentally different from his fellows. If I don't know why I'm bodily and mentally different than my fellows, then I'm not going to want to admit it. I'm not going to think that I am. Therefore, it is not surprising that our drinking careers have been characterized by countless vain attempts to prove we could drink like other people. And you know, like I said last night, I always tried to control my drinking after I started drinking. I watched 9 out of 10 people do that. They'd go sit down at the bar and say, I'm going to, you know, have 2 drinks and then I'm going to go cut the grass. And they did. They went in there, they had 2 drinks, they went home and cut the grass. I go in and say the same thing. I'm going to have 2 drinks and then I'm going to go home and cut the grass. And I'd have 2 drinks, and I'd say, well, you can cut the grass just as good with 4 drinks as you could with 2, and it ain't even near dark. So I have the 4 drinks, and then my mind began to say, to hell with the grass. Let her cut it. She ain't cut the grass before, but she can do it.
Now that's intoxicated.
Thanks. That's intoxicated behavior, now I say. Now I'm drunk. I've got 4 drinks in me, craving 4 more. And the grass is no longer important. The only thing that's important now is getting more and more of the same thing that's killing me. Therefore, the idea that somehow, someday, he will control and enjoy his drinking is the great obsession of every abnormal drinker. And we've already determined that obsession is that thought that overcomes all other thoughts. That someday, some way, we'll be able to drink like those people that have 2 drinks and go cut the grass. Of every abnormal. You know, I didn't like that word abnormal either, and I didn't understand it until it was explained to me. Abnormal just means that what I do is not normal to what other people do. 9 out of 10 people can have those 2 drinks, and I can't, so my behavior is abnormal. My reaction is abnormal. The persistence of this illusion, which is a lie, is astonishing. Many pursue it into the gates of insanity or death. And if you can't see that, you can't see that. Based on the knowledge that we've been given so far, understanding the physical allergy and the mental obsession of alcohol, if I don't understand that, if I'm just here thinking I don't drink because I'm sorry as hell and I'm going to get better, I'm going to do better, I'm crazy as hell, you know, they sent that guy to the psychiatrist that minute ago, and the psychiatrist couldn't do a great deal for him because that wasn't his problem. He wasn't crazy. He had a mental obsession to drink alcohol. We learned that we had to fully concede. I love the way they wrote this. We learned that we had to fully concede to our innermost selves that we were alcoholics. Now, I'm going to tell y'all something. I didn't do that the first week or two I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't do that at all. Everybody in that meeting I went to said, my name is Speedy and I'm an alcoholic, or my name is Larry and I'm an alcoholic, my name is Hines and I'm an alcoholic, and they come around to me and I thought, well, hell, I'm in the room with them, I must be an alcoholic too. So I said, my name is Bob and I'm an alcoholic, not understanding what I was saying. And I thought for the longest time that by my saying that my name is Bob and I'm an alcoholic, that I had taken step one. I had admitted that I was powerless over alcohol, until it was finally pointed out to me that, you know, step one does not say we admitted we were an alcoholic. It said we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that we had no power to drink and no power to quit drinking. It didn't jump on me. This whole shooting match has not jumped on me. It's come real slow. And I've had to struggle with it, and I'm so grateful that that's true. I see people coming to Alcoholics Anonymous now. We had at Gem City one night, we had this young girl, and they called on her, and she talked about the allergy of the body and the obsession of the mind. And because she had the allergy of the body and the obsession of the mind, her life was unmanageable. Because she had the disease of alcoholism, her life was unmanageable. And then she said, I've only been coming 5 days. And I thought, my God, I couldn't even say my own name 5 days. And here she is already in the book. And besides that, she was cute. But she had something going for her. I mean, she really did. After 5 days, we learned that we had to fully concede to our innermost selves that we were alcoholics. Now, in order for me to do that, I've got to understand the disease concept and the doctor's opinion. I keep getting lost. These glasses are... This is the first step in recovery. The delusion that we are like other people, or presently may be, has to be smashed. Smashed. Speedy said you have to take that idea out of your head and put it right there and take a hammer and smash it. Idea has to be smashed. We alcoholics are men and women who have lost the ability to control our drinking. We have lost it. We've not misplaced it. It ain't coming back. If we got it, we got it. If we can't drink when we get here, 40 years down the road, we're not going to be able to drink either. So it has to be smashed. We know that no real alcoholic, he's using that word again, real alcoholic ever recovers control. Why do we say we've recovered then? I hear a lot of argument about that. Why do we say we've recovered if we know that no real alcoholic ever recovers control? He's talking about the physical allergy. The mental obsession can be changed by a personality change sufficient to stay sober, and can grow and stay changed as long as we stay on the program. All of us felt that at times we were regaining control, but such intervals, usually brief, were inevitably followed by still less control, which led in time, and we're sober now, we're not drinking, which led in time to pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. That's a powerful statement. We are convinced to a man that alcoholics of our type are in the grip of a progressive illness. Over any considerable period, we get worse, never better. We are like men who have lost their legs. They never grow new ones. Neither does there appear to be any kind of treatment which will make alcoholics of our kind like other men. We have tried every imaginable remedy. In some instances, there has been brief recovery, followed always by a still worse relapse. Physicians who are familiar with alcoholism agree there is no such thing as making normal drinkers out of an alcoholic. Science may one day accomplish this, and I keep looking in them Globe and Star newspapers in the grocery store to see if they've done that yet. And every once in a while, I'll see where it says, Russian scientists invent pill to make normal drinkers out of alcoholics. And I can see it all the way from the damn meat counter all the way back up to the cash register. So, just to kind of show you where my state of mind is. We'll take a little break here in a minute if Butch wants to. I heard a little story about how you tell a normal drinker and a heavy drinker and an alcoholic. You give them all a drink and you put a fly in each one of them. The normal drinker will pour the drink out or send it back and get another drink. The heavy drinker will take the fly out and drink the drink. The alcoholic will holler, "Spit it out! Spit it out!" And then drink it. Butch?
I don't have much to add to that, except to say that they've already told us that further on we're going to get some clear-cut directions on how we recovered, which is to me means I'm going to get clear-cut directions on how to develop this relationship with my higher power that I'm going to have. But I'm a real alcoholic, and I like to get ahead of things, and I like to stay caught up in some things, especially if I think that it's something that you'd like for me to do, because I really like to please people. But so far, it's important for me to understand that I haven't really been asked to do anything except answer some important questions. So far, all I have been asked to do is to come to some conclusions. I need to come to the conclusion that I am a real alcoholic, and in order to do that, I need to understand as much as I can about what a real alcoholic is. And that doesn't say that I need at this time to know God or to understand God, because there's no possible way that I could have done that the way I lived my life. It says on page 28 that we are with whom we may form a relationship upon simple and understandable terms as soon as we are willing and honest enough to try. And I know that I was not honest. I could not be honest because I had spent so much time being dishonest that it had been conditioned out of me. And I'm just now getting rid of enough fixed ideas about what I thought the problem was to be even able to have a little bit of honesty. They put in the original manuscript in there that it said the only requirement for membership is an honest desire to stop drinking. But somebody knew that when we got here, or at least when I did, that I was not capable of being honest about anything. And I certainly wasn't. I only came here to quit hurting and to get you off my back, not to quit drinking. But now that I know better, I can do a little bit better. And while we take this break, we can just think about what we've been asked to understand so far. And I don't have to make a decision yet. That'll be later on this afternoon. And I don't have to do anything. Thank you, Bob.
One thing right quick. Now, Butch did something today that I have never in a big book study or study anywhere or in a meeting. I've never seen it done before. On page 27, it says, for amplification, see Appendix 2. Now, we already know that 20 pages down the road here, they're going to tell us, please be sure to read Appendix. Why did we go back there and read it right there? Because I would have waited to the last possible minute to go back there and read that.
I would have waited. I waited till the second time.
I would have waited till it says, please be sure. Now, I'm just wondering if maybe we ought to go back there and read it again, just to sort of stay in sync here. Let's take a little break.
I enjoyed that break. And we are talking about more I wrote in my book more truth about alcoholism, and then they immediately began to show me examples of lies. We're on page 31. I'm going to repeat something that we've already read. First full paragraph. Despite all we can say, many who are real alcoholics are not going to believe they are in that class. By every form of self-deception and experimentation, they will try to prove themselves exceptions to the rule, therefore non-alcoholic. And in my case, probably alcoholic, but not the same type of alcoholic you were. That's the scenario I found myself in for many days in the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't understand my problem, so therefore I was ignorant of it. If anyone who is showing inability to control his drinking can do the right about face and drink like a gentleman, our hats are off to him. Heaven knows we have tried hard enough and long enough to drink like other people. We have tried every way we could possibly think of, and here are some of the things that we have tried. I'm going to go through these. Sometimes I think it's good to be able to identify with some of this thinking so that we can understand that it might not be accurate. Here are some of the methods we have tried. Drinking beer only, limiting the number of drinks, never drinking alone, never drinking in the morning, drinking only at home, never having it in the house, never drinking during business hours, drinking only at parties, switching from scotch to brandy, drinking only natural wines, agreeing to resign if ever drunk on the job, taking a trip, not taking a trip, swearing off forever, with and without a solemn oath, taking more physical exercise, reading inspirational books, going to health farms and sanitariums, accepting voluntary commitments to asylums. We could increase the list ad infinitum.
And a normal drinker would not even think of those things, would they? That wouldn't even enter their mind.
We do not like to pronounce any individual as alcoholic, but you can quickly diagnose yourself. Now listen to what they ask us to possibly do. We don't do this much in the fellowship because we just, I don't know, I won't give you my opinion as to why, but they recommend that we step over to the nearest bar room and try some controlled drinking. Try to drink and stop abruptly. Try it more than once. It will not take long for you to decide if you are honest with yourself about it. It may be worth a bad case of jitters if you get a full knowledge of your condition. And this is why I believe that for those people who find it necessary to drink again, I don't believe it is necessarily a bad thing, and I'm not recommending it, but I don't believe it's a bad thing if it will help that individual to understand the powerlessness and the nature of the disease. And it is certainly the way we react when these people come back will help them to have that understanding. Though there is no way of proving it, we believe that early in our drinking careers, most of us could have stopped drinking. But the difficulty is that few alcoholics have enough desire to stop while there is yet time. We have heard of a few instances where people who showed definite signs of alcoholism were able to stop for a long period because of an overpowering desire to do so. Here is one. And we're going to talk about the man of 30. We're not going to cover every example that they give us of normal and insane thinking, but we will talk about this guy. I have known this man, not the man they talk about in the book, but he was my neighbor. I lived in Townsend, Tennessee, and this individual that I knew had worked at the plant, we call it, Alcoa, for 30 years, and he had never, he did not drink during that time. He was a kind man. He did not seem to be restless, irritable, and discontented to my way of thinking. But when he retired, the same thing happened to him, and I don't believe he lasted quite as long as this gentleman. A man of 30 was doing a great deal of spree drinking. He was very nervous in the morning after these bouts and quieted himself with more liquor. He was ambitious to succeed in business, but saw that he would get nowhere if he drank at all. Once he started, he had no control whatever. He made up his mind that until he had been successful in business and had retired, he would not touch another drop. An exceptional man, he remained bone dry for 25 years and retired at the age of 55 after a successful and happy business career. Then he fell victim to a belief which practically every alcoholic has, that his long period of sobriety and self-discipline had qualified him to drink as other men. And I used to think that if I got 30 days, that was a long period of sobriety. Out came his carpet slippers and a bottle. In 2 months, he was in a hospital, puzzled and humiliated. He tried to regulate his drinking for a while, making several trips to the hospital meantime. Then, gathering all his forces, he attempted to stop altogether and found he could not. Every means of solving his problem, which money could buy, was at his disposal. Every attempt failed. Though a robust man at retirement, he went to pieces quickly and was dead within 4 years. This case contains a powerful lesson. Most of us have believed, or at least suspected, that if we remained sober for a long stretch, we could thereafter drink normally. But here's a man who at 55 years found he was just where he had left off at 30. We have seen the truth demonstrated again and again. Once an alcoholic, always an alcoholic. Commencing to drink after a period of sobriety, we are in a short time as bad as ever. If we are planning to stop drinking, there must be no reservation or lie in our minds of any kind, or any lurking notion that someday we will be immune to alcohol. And there's another example of the lie. And what I'm beginning to understand is that they're giving us some different examples so that we can see that as different individuals, we may suffer from the allergy of the body or the obsession of the mind to a different degree. The important fact is that we have it. I can look across the room and I can see a man who may not trigger this allergy with 5 drinks. And that will allow me to start believing whatever I may believe, want to believe, to let me off the hook. And I may see a person who is a periodic or binge drinker who is able to overcome the obsession for long periods of time. Yet, invariably, the obsession will allow him to believe a lie and he goes on a tremendous bender. But my thinking allows me to look at that man and say, I believe that I can handle it this time. These are the things that I use to let me be different instead of to identify. So it doesn't matter whether I've got it real bad or just a little bit, as long as I know that I've got it. And if I can remember that I've got it, then I'll know that I need to do something differently.
I was just thinking the story about the old man and the little boy and the donkey. And, thinking about what people say and listening to what people say, listening to human solutions, and the old man and the little boy and the donkey. The little boy was riding the donkey and they passed a group of people. And that group of people said, look at that old man, look at that little boy riding that donkey and making that old man walk. He ought to be ashamed. He ought to let that old man ride. So the old man put the boy on the ground and got on the donkey himself. And he was going down the road and he met another group of people. And that group of people said, look at that old man riding that donkey. That donkey is strong enough he could be carrying both of them and that little boy wouldn't have to walk. So he got off and got the little boy and put him on the donkey, and they're going down the road and they met another group of people. And that group of people said, look at that old man and that boy riding that donkey. They could be carrying him a little bit if they would. So the old man got the little boy off and he got off and he got the donkey up on his shoulders and he was carrying the donkey down the road. And they came to a swinging bridge and he started out across the bridge. And he lost his balance and he lost his donkey. His donkey fell over the edge and fell off down in the river and was killed. And the moral of the story was, you can lose your ass if you listen to enough people.
You want me to read some more? You want me to read some more? Now we're on page 34. For those who are unable to drink moderately, the question is how to stop altogether. Now, if we've already decided that we're a real alcoholic and that we're not a heavy drinker and that we cannot stop or moderate, then this is for us. It says, we are assuming, of course, that the reader desires to stop. Now, here again, it is my belief, and this is my opinion, and I'll try to always qualify what I say by that. There are a lot of people, possibly in the rooms of AA today, who are not even real alcoholics, who certainly have no desire to stop, who may not understand that they even need to stop. They're here for a number of reasons. They might have not found anybody else that would hug them, and we'll hug them. And they might be here looking for a job, or they might be here looking for a boyfriend or a girlfriend, and that's okay. They're certainly welcome, because the only desire to be, the only requirement to be here is the desire to come here. But I've got to answer these questions for myself. I've got to stop looking around the room trying to figure out my life according to what I see around me. Now, I happen to be a real alcoholic, and I want to stop. But whether such a person can quit upon a non-spiritual basis depends upon the extent to which he has already lost the power to choose whether he will drink or not. And I've got to know that for me. It doesn't matter what I know about you. I have got to know that for me. Many of us felt that we had plenty of character. There was a tremendous urge to cease forever, yet we found it impossible. This is the baffling feature of alcoholism as we know it, this utter inability to leave it alone, no matter how great the necessity or the wish. I cannot see the truth about the way I drink, so therefore I take a drink based on the lie. I trigger the allergy and become intoxicated, and therefore I cannot see the truth about anything else from that point on. How then shall we help our readers determine to their own satisfaction whether they are one of us? The experiment of quitting for a period of time will be helpful, but we think we can render an even greater service to alcoholic sufferers and perhaps to the medical fraternity. So we shall describe some of the mental states that precede a relapse into drinking, for obviously this is the crux of the problem. Now, this is my thinking while sober. What sort of thinking dominates an alcoholic who repeats time after time the desperate experiment of the first drink? Friends who have reasoned with him after a spree which has brought him to the point of divorce or bankruptcy are mystified when he walks directly into a saloon. Why does he? Of what is he thinking? Our first example is a friend we shall call Jim. This man has a charming wife and family. He inherited a lucrative automobile agency. He had a commendable world war record. He is a good salesman. Everybody likes him. He is an intelligent man, normal so far as we can see. And I fit some of those categories before I got really bad sick myself. I think we can identify with a lot of the things that Jim is. And you feel free to comment as I wander down through here. Except for a nervous disposition. He's a little restless and maybe a little bit discontented, but for the most part, he's still doing pretty good. Said he did no drinking at all until he was 35. In a few years, he became so violent when intoxicated that he had to be committed. On leaving the asylum, he came into contact with us. We told him what we knew of alcoholism.
Step one.
And the answer we had found.
Step two.
He made a beginning.
Step three.
His family was reassembled, and he began to work as a salesman for the business he had lost through drinking. All went well for a time, but he failed to enlarge his spiritual life.
He failed to take the rest of the steps.
To his consternation, he found himself drunk half a dozen times in rapid succession. On each of these occasions, we worked with him, reviewing carefully what had happened. He agreed he was a real alcoholic and in a serious condition.
Step one.
He knew he faced another trip to the asylum if he kept on. Moreover, he would lose his family, for whom he had deep affection. Yet he got drunk again. We asked him to tell us exactly how it happened. This is his story. I came to work on Tuesday morning. I remember I felt irritated that I had to be a salesman for a concern I once owned.
As Butch goes through here and reads these statements, I'm going to say what we think is normal thinking. Now, he showed up to work on Tuesday morning, and he's a little irritated that he has to work for a concern that he once owned. That's normal to be upset about that, okay?
Said I had a few words with the boss, but nothing serious.
Now, where in the hell was you on Monday?
Then I decided to drive into the country and see one of my prospects for a car.
This is normal thinking. He's a car salesman. That's what he does.
On the way, I felt hungry, so I stopped at a roadside place where they have a bar.
Now, this is normal thinking. And, you know, they didn't have McDonald's and Arby's and things like that in those days. And most of the roadside places did have a bar in it, I suppose. They did where I came from.
I had no intention of drinking.
Normal thinking.
I just thought I would get a sandwich. I also had the notion that I might find a customer for a car at this place, which was familiar, for I had been going to it for years.
Yeah, this is just normal thinking. Now, he's not going in there to drink. He's going in there to get a sandwich and a glass of milk, and he might find a customer in there.
I had eaten there many times during the months I was sober.
He's not going there to drink now. He's already been there before, and he didn't drink, so he's not worried about that.
I sat down at a table and ordered a sandwich and a glass of milk.
Hungry, normal thinking.
Still no thought of drinking. I ordered another sandwich and decided to have another glass of milk.
He was hungry.
Suddenly. Right now. The thought crossed my mind that if I were to put an ounce of whiskey in my milk, it couldn't hurt me on a full stomach.
That is not sane thinking. That is not normal thinking.
In view of his history.
He's not going to take some whiskey and put it in the milk and drink it and go back to that asylum.
Now he takes some action based on that insane thinking. I ordered a whiskey and poured it into the milk. I vaguely sensed I was not being any too smart, but felt reassured as I was taking the whiskey on a full stomach. My goodness. The experiment went so well that I ordered another whiskey and poured it into more milk. That didn't seem to bother me, so I tried another.
What's he done now? He's triggered the allergy, see, and don't make any difference what he thinks now. He's drinking.
See, his mind and his body have to get the liquor and pour it in the milk, but it is his body that's craving the alcohol. That's where I got mixed up. I said, well, I did that, but it was my body that demanded it, just as if I were totally without water for a long period of time. I would have to seek the water, but nevertheless, it's the body that's demanding it. Thus started one more journey to the asylum for Jim. Here was the threat of commitment, the loss of family and position, to say nothing of that intense mental and physical suffering which drinking always caused him. He had much knowledge about himself as an alcoholic, step one, yet all reasons for not drinking were easily pushed aside in favor of the foolish idea that he could take whiskey if only he mixed it with milk.
The thought that overcomes all other thoughts.
Whatever the precise definition of the word may be, we call this plain insanity. How can such a lack of proportion of the ability to think straight be called anything else? He simply cannot see the truth. You may think this an extreme case. To us it is not far-fetched, for this kind of thinking has been characteristic of every single one of us. We have sometimes reflected more than Jim did upon the consequences, but there was always the curious mental phenomenon that parallel with our sound reasoning, there inevitably ran some insanely trivial excuse for taking the first drink. My mind will provide for me the necessary lie if I have not had a spiritual awakening and if I have not had a higher power remove the obsession. Now at the bottom of the page, it says, our behavior is as absurd and incomprehensible with respect to the first drink as that of an individual with a passion, say, for jaywalking. He gets a thrill out of skipping in front of the fast-moving vehicles. He enjoys himself for a few years in spite of friendly warnings. Up to this point, you'd label him as a foolish chap having queer ideas of fun. Now, we had decided maybe that we wouldn't do the jaywalker, but it's pretty quick, and I'm just going to read it without comment, and then I'll let Bob do three. So luck then deserts him, and he's slightly injured several times in succession. You'd expect him, if he were normal, to cut it out. Presently, he is hit again, and this time has a fractured skull. Now, I got my skull almost fractured, and I didn't even jaywalk. Within a week after leaving the hospital, a fast-moving trolley car breaks his arm. He tells you he has decided to stop jaywalking for good.
Made a resolution.
But in a few weeks, he breaks both legs. On through the years, this conduct continues, accompanied by his continual promises to be careful or to keep off the streets altogether. Finally, he can no longer work, his wife gets a divorce, and he is held up to ridicule. He tries every known means to get the jaywalking idea out of his head. He tries church, self-help books, new girlfriend, and several other things. He shuts himself up in an asylum, hoping to mend his ways. But the day he comes out, he rests in front of a fire engine, which breaks his back. Such a man would be crazy, wouldn't he? You may think our illustration is too ridiculous, but is it? We who have been through the ringer have to admit, if we substituted alcoholism for jaywalking, the illustration would fit us exactly. However intelligent we may have been in other respects, where alcohol has been involved, we have been strangely insane. It's strong language, but isn't it true? Now, I know that I was, when I drank a lot, I did some things that were probably dangerous, and at one point I fell out of the back of a pickup truck, and I was knocked unconscious. Luckily, I wasn't hurt too badly, but I can remember the litany of excuses that I used for that happening. It was the driver's fault. It was any number of things. But I don't believe that I made the connection. Had I not been drunk, I might have either been holding on, or I might not have even been sitting on the tailgate of a pickup truck to start with. But now, many, many years later, I was up here at Altoona Lake, and I was boating, and I stepped off the boat, and I hit the dock, and I was knocked out. And when I came to, they had ice on my face, and I was going to be okay. Luckily, I wasn't hurt too bad. But I immediately knew why I had been hurt. It was because I had been careless, and I was not being safety conscious enough, and I stepped off the dock too quick. So my thinking had been repaired in a short time over some things like that.
We're going to, some of us are thinking what you tell us is true, but it doesn't fully apply. And it helps me to understand that there's different degrees of the allergy of the body and the obsession of the mind, you know. Some of the things that you did or some of the things that you do, I might not have done. I might not have even thought about doing. But you and I have the same problem and the same solution. We admit we have some of these symptoms, but we have not gone to the extreme you fellas did. Nor do we have to. Nor are we likely to, for we understand ourselves so well after what you have told us that such things cannot happen again. We have not lost everything in life through drinking, and we certainly do not intend to. Thanks for the information. And that's me when I first went to Alcoholics Anonymous back in the early 70s. I went to 3 meetings, and I heard what those people said about, they had lost everything. They had lost their jobs, their families, their fortunes. And what I heard them say was that they had drowned their sons in the bathtub and put the cat in the microwave. And they had just done some really dirty, rotten, filthy, stupid, damn things. And I hadn't done those things. I still had the same wife, the same job, the same children, the same dog. You know, everything was, and I could not relate to the stories that they were telling. So I came home and convinced my significant other to go to a meeting with me to hear what they were talking about, and she did that. And I said, I'm not an alcoholic, am I? She said, no, if that's what an alcoholic is, that's not what you are. And see, I couldn't relate to the rotten, dirty, filthy things those people were talking about had been done to them, and that they had done. So I couldn't stay. I didn't hear anything. 5 years later, when I came back, I heard something different. This time I heard, I have a problem and I can't solve it. That may be true of certain non-alcoholic people who, though drinking foolishly and heavily, at the present time are able to stop or moderate because their brains and bodies, they haven't reached the degree that some of us have been damaged as ours were. But the actual or potential alcoholic, with hardly an exception, will be absolutely unable to stop drinking on the basis of self-knowledge. This is a point we wish to emphasize and re-emphasize to smash home upon our alcoholic readers as it has been revealed to us out of bitter experience. Let us take another illustration. Now, Fred here is a high-bottom drunk. And we'll watch Fred go from alcoholic thinking to intoxicated behavior, and maybe we can begin to see the difference in that. Fred is a partner in a well-known accounting firm. His income is good. He has a fine home. He's happily married and the father of promising children of college age. He has so attractive a personality that he makes friends with everyone. And he is tall. If ever there was a successful businessman, it is Fred. To all appearances, he is a stable, well-balanced individual, yet he is alcoholic. Now, why is he alcoholic if he's all those things and he's not dirty, rotten, filthy, dumb, stupid, crazy, sorry, and he's an alcoholic? He's an alcoholic because he can't drink.
And he can't quit.
And he can't quit, and he don't even know it. He's an alcoholic. We first saw Fred about a year ago in a hospital where he had gone to recover from a bad case of jitters. It was his first experience of this kind, and he was much ashamed of it.
Ignorance.
Far from admitting he was an alcoholic, he told himself he came to the hospital to rest his nerves. The doctor intimated strongly that he might be worse than he realized. For a few days he was depressed about his condition. He made up his mind to quit drinking altogether. He made that resolution. It never occurred to him that perhaps he could not do so. In spite of his character and standing, Fred would not believe himself an alcoholic. He wouldn't take step one, much less accept a spiritual remedy for his problem.
Step two.
We told him what we knew about alcoholism.
Steps one and two.
He was interested and conceded that he had some of the symptoms, but he was a long way from admitting that he could do nothing about it himself. He was positive that this humiliating experience, plus the knowledge he had acquired, would keep him sober the rest of his life. Self-knowledge would fix it. No human power can relieve our alcoholism. Our own minds cannot fix our own minds. We heard no more of Fred for a while. One day we were told that he was back in the hospital. This time he was quite shaky. He soon indicated he was anxious to see us. The story he told is most instructive, for here was a chap absolutely convinced he had to stop drinking, who had no excuse for drinking, who exhibited splendid judgment and determination in all his other concerns, yet he was flat on his back nevertheless. Let him tell you about it. I was much impressed with what you fellas said about alcoholism, and I frankly did not believe it would be possible for me to drink again. I rather appreciated your ideas about the subtle insanity which precedes the taking of the next first drink. The crux of the problem. Subtle insanity which precedes the first drink.
Main problem centers in our mind, not in our bodies.
Not in our bodies.